From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with Chris Menges, Britain's foremost cinematographer. He won Oscars for his work on The Killing Fields and The Mission. His new film, A World Apart, marks his debut as a director. It just won the Grand Special Jury Prize at Cannes. Also today, I speak with jazz singer Sylvia Sims. She says whatever success she's met with, she owes to the inspiration and friendship of Fats Waller, Frank Sinatra, and Billie Holiday. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the doo-wop group The Flamingos. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tries to make sense of our Pledge of Allegiance and the Star-Spangled Banner. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The new film, A World Apart, just won the Grand Special Jury Prize at the Cannes Film Festival, and its three leading actresses shared the Cannes Award for Best Actress. The film was directed by my guest, Chris Menges. This is his debut as a feature film director, but he's no newcomer to movies. Menges is an internationally acclaimed cinematographer who's won Oscars for his work on The Mission and The Killing Fields. He learned a lot about camera work, shooting many documentaries in the 60s and 70s for British television. His new movie, A World Apart, is set in Johannesburg, South Africa, in 1963, when the 90-Day Act had just been passed, allowing South African authorities to arrest and detain people for 90 days without trial. In 1963, Chris Menges was actually in Johannesburg covering the 90-Day Act for his first documentary for the British series World in Action. The screenplay for the new film, A World Apart, was written by Sean Slovo, who grew up in South Africa in a prosperous white family. But her parents were both members of the outlawed African National Congress, and her mother reported on the injustices of apartheid for the Alternative Press. When Sean Slovo was 13, her mother was arrested under the 90-Day Act. Her father was driven into exile. A World Apart is about how apartheid devastated Slovo's family and the family of their black maid. Slovo wrote the screenplay after her mother was murdered while in exile, the victim of a parcel bomb. I spoke with director Chris Menges from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him if there were any visual details he remembered from the actual events he witnessed in 1963 that he wanted to get into his new movie.
I was very fortunate to have been sent to Johannesburg in 1963 by World in Action to do a report on what it was like to live under apartheid, as you say, at the time of the 90-day law, and shortly after Nelson Mandela had been imprisoned and the banning of the ANC. I came away from there, I was 22 at the time, I came away from there feeling black about what it felt like being there and observing apartheid. And I think details I remembered, but more than anything, it got me involved in what was happening in South Africa.
Since you were so young, was that something of a turning point for you politically?
Well, what is going on in South Africa it's the fight for democracy, and obviously that's something that I think we all feel very strongly about. But also it's about racism too, which is an international problem. I think these are important issues, and certainly when you're 22, they seem to be even more important issues.
Some of the cast that you were working with were from South Africa and really understood the way apartheid worked and had been imprisoned themselves in South Africa, whereas others weren't from South Africa and probably did not know nearly as much about what life in South Africa was like. Did you have to kind of bring everybody to the same level of understanding while making the movie?
Yes, I mean, obviously, for me, the most important thing was to make the film as accurate as possible and as believable as possible. And in that search, the city of Bulawayo in Zimbabwe was... I chose to shoot there because there are many refugees from South Africa, both black and white, living in Bulawayo and in Zimbabwe. But also Bulawayo is very near the South African border. So how can I say that we had first-hand knowledge from many people who know about the struggle in South Africa. And they were very important to the film, in a sense, to make it authentic, and they, of course, helped the professional actors with their understanding and knowledge of what it's like to live under apartheid. So those details were very important.
I think some of the people who played the black South Africans in your movie had actually lived in South Africa and were in exile from there. What about the white people who played the wealthy and the elite, the apartheid supporters in South Africa? Were they people who had actually supported apartheid? Like, do you know what I mean? Were they similar to the characters that they played as well?
Can I ask a question? Are you talking about people like Barbara, who comes from the States? Or
No. I'm talking about the people in the secondary roles.
Mm. Well, for instance, for the film, we needed quite a strong sense of a police force. So
yeah.
In Bulawayo, we went to the local rugby club and told the guys about what the film was about, and many of them did want to participate in the film. Then it was a question of getting a South African police officer to teach them in South African tactics that, you know, were appropriate for the year 1963. So in all details, we tried to make it as accurate as possible.
My guest is Chris Menges, who directed the new film A World Apart. Now, this is your directorial debut of a feature fiction film. Why did you want to start directing?
Mm. As a cameraman, I think you basically are serving the needs of directors, and every now and then I would sneak off anyhow and make documentary films, because it's very hard to serve other people's needs all the time. I read this A World Apart, written by Sean Slover, about 2 years ago. A very beautiful script. It moved me immensely. It moved me because of the basic political issue in South Africa, but it also moved me because it was a very beautiful story about a mother and a daughter, and perhaps a lost childhood even. I come from a family of many children, so in a sense, when I read the script, Sean's script, I had a vision of this film. I became very passionate about it and sort of embraced it and said to Sean, "Oh, I don't want to be the cameraman on this film, I want to be the director." And I was very lucky I got the opportunity.
Now, it's interesting to me that this film is really a film about people, about relationships between people, about racism. Now, in comparing it to the two films you won the Academy Awards for cinematography for, The Mission and The Killing Fields, I mean, also about people, but there were visual extremes in those movies in a way that there's not in this. You know, in The Mission, there were those incredible scenes with the waterfalls and the, you know, cascading water. And in The Killing Fields, there were those incredible scenes where, of the killing fields themselves, of those endless fields of skulls and bones. This is really a movie about people, and you didn't go for those kinds of visual extremes in it, if you know what I mean.
Mm. I suppose each story makes certain demands. And this is very much more a story about suburbia, about a family. So I just guess the demands were not so cinematic. They were not, the so to speak, the canvas didn't need to be so large and big. It needed, in a sense, to be more focused.
Thank you for finding the word. Cinematic is the word that I meant. You didn't go for the big sweeping pictures.
Mm.
You really went for the acting performances, in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. I suppose the person who had the biggest influence on me is the British director Ken Loach, and he always talks about the importance of making a story believable and keeping the technical aspects, in a sense, to the minimum, and concentrating more on the freedom of the actors. And I guess this story needed that kind of respect. I guess that's the route I followed.
You have filmed documentaries in, I believe, 12 different wars. You've shot footage. And it seems to me that by shooting so much newsreel footage and documentary footage of real people in real events, you know something of how people react in extremes. And one thing that really struck me about your movie is that there's no overacting in it. Do you know, In a lot of films, things are over-dramatized. The face reads perhaps a little too much. And I'm wondering if you think your experience being behind the camera in so many real events has made you very sensitive to the way people really behave in extreme situations.
Gosh, I don't know. I don't think I'm really qualified to answer that. But certainly another person who had a big influence on me was Cartier-Bresson, and he always talks about the decisive moment. I suppose it's the moment to try and catch the real sense of what's happening. In A World Apart, it was important for me to be surrounded with people who had knowledge of the story, to be surrounded with people who cared very much about the film. I think it was more a question of having once perhaps chosen actors as wisely as possible was to leave them and know when to, so to speak, to interrupt and put in new ideas, but also to know when to leave them be and observe and try and catch those moments.
Did you have to fight the temptation to shoot this movie yourself at all? I know you wanted to direct it, but once you were actually directing it, were there things that you really wanted to set up yourself since you're so used to being the cinematographer?
Well, as I said earlier on, I think probably the most important thing if you're going to be a director is to have a sense of where you want to go, what you want to do, to have a vision of the piece. And I knew that it was very important that I spent most of my time, most of my energy with the actors, particularly as many of them were not professional actors. But I knew, in a sense, where I wanted the camera and what I wanted the camera to do, but I was incredibly relieved to give the responsibility, the final responsibility for the photography to Peter Bijou, who did a very handsome job.
Obviously, you couldn't shoot the film in South Africa. How did you find a place to shoot it that could pass for South Africa and would also be receptive to the movie?
Mm-hmm. Well, in 63, when I was in Johannesburg for World in Action, we went on up to Bulawayo in what was then Rhodesia on the way to the Congo. And I remember being in Bulawayo in 63. Bulawayo, for historical reasons, became a backwater in Zimbabwe. And actually, in terms of architecture, was perfect to represent Johannesburg suburbs in 1963. And also, as I mentioned earlier on, that the many refugees, both black and white, could bring first-hand knowledge and advice to the film so that the film could be as sort of as truthful as possible, as believable as possible.
Were there any scenes within the film that were hard to make because of the location?
No, working in Zimbabwe was very exciting. Because Bulawayo is a small city, every location was within 10 minutes of the hotel, so we saved an enormous amount of time. The enthusiasm of the Zimbabweans to work on the film, but also to participate in the story, was magnificent. It was a very enjoyable shoot. I mean, hard work, of course, but very enjoyable.
Chris Menges is my guest, and he directed the new film, A World Apart. Will you go back to cinematography now that you've started directing?
Difficult. I've always tried to seek stories that I could personally learn from, and I think I would like to do both, given the opportunity, both to direct and all to photograph. It's really just a question of the story, I think, for me anyhow.
Now, you've done many documentaries in your career, dozens, right?
Yes, many dozens.
It seems to me you've taken many risks in the documentaries that you've shot. Some of them were documentaries of war. Then there's a series of films that you did on the opium trade, in which, from what I understand, you had to basically hide out during a lot of the shooting.
Mm. Adrian Cowell and myself, we went to Burma twice, to Shan State. The last time we went was in 74, 75. Unfortunately, during that experience, our little army, the Shan State Army, got attacked by remnants of the Chiang Kai-shek's soldiers. And they were much stronger group, so we became trapped inside Burma. There was a difficult time, yes.
And it must have been hard to get the footage out of there.
Yes, well, to get ourselves out of there was very hard, too.
So you're really used to taking enormous risks and putting yourself on the line to get a movie made.
I suppose some of the jobs that I've worked on, some of the films I've worked on, they have been quite dangerous, yes. But I guess that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is sort of, in a sense, is to seek knowledge and to try and work on stories that are interesting and that perhaps are important, and whether they be in the middle of the Amazon or in Tibet or in the streets of New York or wherever. I think the cinema and television have an important, they're important to our lives, and it's important that they're treated with respect, and the work that you do is as honest as possible, can be reflected on by the public and by ourselves.
You use the word honesty, that you want to do films that are honest to the subject and honest to the material. In doing a film set in 1963 in South Africa, what were some of the considerations in making it honest, in not making it...
polemical.
Or over...
dramatic.
Over-dramatic or glamorized in some way. You know, glamorized in retrospect in the way that movies can glamorize history and take, you know, just make some of the horror stylish, if you know what I mean.
I don't know. That's a difficult question to answer. I think one, in my case, I'll read a script, and if I'm sort of enthused by it, if I become totally obsessed with it, somehow, I suppose some innate responsibility brings you to the work and makes you treat it seriously and, you know, take it on. I hate exploitative cinema. And also, in a sense, because this was Sean's story, that in a way, that was a very sort of strong leveler about a child trying to come to terms with her mother's politics.
Was there an incident that stayed in your mind from 1963 when you were actually filming in South Africa, an incident that you felt you really had to be true to, that you kept seeing in your mind thinking, this is the way it looked, this is what I have to capture, this is the way it really was, this is what I have to be true to?
I think I came away from this from working in Johannesburg in 63 with great anger. I think of all these years that Nelson Mandela has been in prison. I get so angry when I hear him described as a terrorist. I think of America, who gained its independence, fought for its independence from the British. They had to use guns. I cannot understand how Mandela is so treated. He's a man of enormous strength. I think people are very ignorant about what's happening in South Africa. I think the propaganda from South Africa, from the government, is somehow allowed to be printed in the newspapers without anybody questioning it.
You know, a couple of reviewers have mentioned that the two recent big films about South Africa, your film and Cry Freedom, were both making statements against apartheid, but also both from the perspective of white South Africans opposing apartheid as opposed to from the perspective of black South Africans. And I wonder why you think that's happened, if that's just coincidence or what, that the big films about apartheid are being from a white perspective.
Well, this story of World Apart comes from Sean's need to come to terms with her mother's death. Sean's mother was assassinated in 1982. So, in a sense, I for Sean, this the writing of this script was to come to terms with her mother's death, and also many things, I think, were not said between herself and her mother, and she needed to come to terms with that. It's a coincidence. Of course, there are many stories that should be said, told, black stories, but this just happens to be one, and it happens to be Sean, happens to be white, but I don't think it in any way makes it less valid. And talking about Cry Freedom, I think Cry Freedom had important things to say. And also, certainly in Britain, there are many more members of the anti-apartheid organization because of Cry Freedom. So I think, you know, it's Cry Freedom, World Apart, and the next film that Uzan Palsy is doing in Zimbabwe now, and she's a black director, all have a place.
My guest is Chris Menges, who directed the new film A World Apart. He also won Academy Awards for cinematography for his work in The Mission and The Killing Fields. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Director and cinematographer Chris Menges is my guest. You know, I want to get back to something you said a little bit earlier. You mentioned that when you were casting and working on the film, you had hired a former white South African police officer to work with the actors who would be playing police officers and interrogators to show them how it was really done?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me some more about that? Who was this person and had... Was he still a police officer?
No. As I said earlier on, there are many refugees, both black and white, living in Zimbabwe. And they also came with great knowledge and were incredibly important to the film to make it accurate. And that involved many, many scenes of all sort of, you know, the funeral scenes, all the scenes, in fact. We had technical advisors left, right and centre who were absolutely invaluable.
So he had been a South African police officer, then he went into exile from South Africa?
Mm.
Because he could no longer be a police officer? Because he no longer wanted to be a police officer?
I'm not going to answer this question.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I didn't...
I'm purposely being...
I didn't realize that.
I mean, just to sort of regroup again, Zimbabwe is a frontline state.
Right.
And there's an enormous amount of tension going on. There are a lot of people being maimed by parcel bombs. You have to be quite circumspect, quite careful about what you say.
No, I understand that. I didn't realize that that's but, what I mean, you were getting at. No, sure. Well, but so that must have made it pretty difficult, in fact, for some of the people to participate in the movie.
I think that there are a lot of brave people. Inside South Africa and in exile who were part of the struggle for liberation and democracy in South Africa.
So you think that some of the people wanted to be in the movie to make a statement even though it might endanger them in some way?
I think many people wanted to be involved in the film to perhaps set the record straight.
Did you need any kind of protection when you were working on the movie?
No, I mean, we were shooting in Zimbabwe. It was, the Zimbabwean government were extremely helpful. And it, as I said earlier on, it was an incredibly good shoot from that point of view.
My guest is Chris Menges. You directed the film The Killing Fields, which was set in part in Cambodia and told in part the life of Dith Prenn, who... basically narrowly escaped Cambodia after the Khmer Rouge took over. There was really some incredible footage there, and I guess what I really remember is an image I referred to earlier of literally the killing fields, of fields of bones and skeletons and skulls. Can you describe how you arranged that shot? I mean, how you set up that image for the movie?
Well... I was actually the cameraman on the film. The director was...
No, I realise that. Well,
enormous amount of research is obviously undertaken on any project. And basically, we had advisors, Cambodian advisors, but also we had photographic records. And basically, an enormous amount of trouble was taken to make things as accurate as possible. I mean, it's this whole business that if you're going out to tell a story... first of all, try and stand your feet square on the concrete, and then, so to speak, you're in a position to make the film happen. Detail is so important. So with the help of advisors and with photographic references, we were able to, so to speak, copy that and create that. And of course, the actual skulls and the bodies were mainly casts.
Oh, were they?
Mm.
And a question about the mission. You know the opening sequence with one of the missionaries tied to a cross,
mm.
and he's set to float down a river and mm. then down a waterfall?
Mm.
How did you position yourself to get that shot?
Well, the opening scenes are shot, we actually shot outside Santa Marta in Colombia. And of course, the big waterfall itself is in Iguazu. So where we're shooting near Santa Marta in Colombia, it's although it's quite a fast-moving stream, it is a stream. And the stuntman was tied to the cross, but quite capable of breaking himself free at any second if he wanted to. And the scene with the cross going over the Iguazu waterfalls was done with a dummy. The hardest thing of all in shooting Iguazu was actually being able to move the camera and the camera crew from locations to locations, because the waterfalls are surrounded by very large boulders, and there's, as you can imagine, an enormous amount of water pressure. So basically what happened is the construction crew built several miles of walkways, which meant that we could get to the sort of positions where we wanted the camera very, very quickly. Without that, we would have been there for weeks and weeks and weeks. So it was well organized, well thought through. It's teamwork.
You're a British cinematographer and director. You were trained, I assume, in England. Do you think that there are any big differences between the British approach and the approach in the United States to shooting movies?
I don't think so. In fact, I was trained by an American director cameraman called whose name is Alan Forbes, who comes from Boston. He trained me in London. No, I don't think so. I think, in a sense, filmmaking is a very international craft, and I think I think the stories are in the thing that count.
I have one last question for you. This was your directorial debut on a feature film. It's the first time you directed actors. Now, the three main actresses in your movie split the Best Actress Award at the Cannes Film Festival. That's really quite an honor for them, and also for you, since it's the first time you've directed before. Did you feel that you'd learned a lot about directing actresses and actors from watching other directors? I guess I'm interested in finding out something of how you did it your first time out.
Mm. I had some very, very good teachers, like Ken Loach, Roland Joffe, Stephen Frears, Bill Forsyth. I've had some very, very good teachers. I've been very, very fortunate. I think I did learn a lot. There's no doubt about it. Doing the work is where you learn. We were absolutely thrilled that they won this award, because Barbara's won it before, but Linda is not an actress, she's an architect, and Jodie's never acted in her life before. So we were absolutely thrilled. I just hope that the awards will make more people see the film, or make them want to see it.
Well, I thank you very much for the time you've spent with us. Thank you very much for speaking with us. My guest has been Chris Menges, and he directed the new film A World Apart, which is set in Johannesburg in 1963. It's the first feature film he directed. He's best known as a cinematographer and won two Oscars for his work on The Killing Fields and The Mission. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with Josiah Thompson, a philosopher turned detective. I hope you can join us. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When jazz singer Sylvia Sims was 15, she used to stand outside the clubs on New York's 52nd Street to hear Billie Holiday sing. As Sims' career developed, she befriended Holiday, as well as Fats Waller and Frank Sinatra. Coming up, I talk with Sylvia Sims about her friends and her songs. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Flamingos, the Chicago doo-wop group that survived from the early 50s through the 70s, but is best remembered for its recording of I Only Have Eyes for You. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg marks Flag Day by asking why the Pledge of Allegiance and the Star-Spangled Banner are so confusing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. President Reagan announced today that White House Chief of Staff Howard Baker is leaving his post as of July 1st. The president says Baker, a former senator from Tennessee, is leaving for personal reasons, not because of any policy dispute. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The man who once said he would stay at the Reagan White House until it was time to lock the door and turn out the lights has decided to depart a bit earlier than that. Baker wants to return to private life. His wife has been suffering from a back ailment, and recently his elderly stepmother was hospitalized. Baker joined the administration as the replacement for Donald Reagan in February of last year and helped stabilize the White House during the Iran-Contra investigations. During his 16 months as chief of staff, Baker oversaw the final negotiations and the signing of the INF Treaty with the Soviet Union, as well as two summit meetings between the president and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. His replacement is Deputy Chief of Staff Kenneth Duberstein. One other personnel note at the White House today, it was announced that Communications Director and longtime Baker associate Tom Griscom will also be resigning, although no date has been given. The president said he's going to miss Baker, adding, quote, he served very, very well. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
The apparent Democratic presidential nominee, Michael Dukakis, today outlined his defense and foreign policy agenda. In a speech at the State Department, Dukakis said he would replace President Reagan's strategic defense initiative with a conventional defense initiative to help protect Europe.
We don't need SDI, we need CDI. We need to follow through on the conventional defense initiative begun by leaders in the Congress to apply advanced technology to the challenge of fighting and winning a conventional war. We don't need MX missiles running around on railroad cars. We need an anti-tank weapon that can stop Soviet tanks.
The Massachusetts governor pledged a strong commitment to NATO and outlined a program for reducing the risk of war in Europe. He also accused South Africa of engaging in terrorist acts and blatant racism against its own people. And he said South Africa is committing naked military aggression against its neighbors. Today, the judge in the Iran-Contra trial rejected a request by the prosecution to allow simultaneous trials for two of the defendants, Oliver North and John Poindexter. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Last week, Judge Gerhard Gesell ruled that the four Iran-Contra defendants must be tried separately in four individual trials in order to protect their constitutional rights. Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh then suggested that North and Poindexter be tried together, with two juries hearing the evidence. That way, if any of the evidence against North violated Poindexter's rights, the Poindexter jury could be excused from the courtroom for that portion of the evidence, and vice versa. But today, Judge Gesell ruled that the two-jury procedure is too cumbersome and still could violate the rights of the defendants. Gesell's ruling means that Walsh must try each of the defendants separately. Legal experts have said that in a conspiracy case like this one, the requirements for separate trials puts the prosecutor at a distinct disadvantage. Walsh indicated last week that the first defendant to face trial will be Oliver North. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Nicaraguan rebel leaders met today with Reagan administration officials to explore the future of peace efforts with the Sandinista government. The Contras want more military aid now that the latest peace talks have broken down. The rebels say their negotiating stance was weakened during the 11 weeks of peace talks. They claim the Sandinistas have taken advantage of a ceasefire to improve their military position. Contra leaders also plan meetings this week with congressional leaders. Stock prices rose sharply today on news of a big drop in the merchandise trade deficit in April. The trade gap narrowed by 15.5% to $9.9 billion. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 25 points to close at 2124.47. Advances led declines 5-2 on volume of 227 million shares. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The vocal group The Flamingos first topped the rhythm and blues charts in the mid-50s and had hits on and off until 1971, outlasting most other doo-wop groups. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says their success had a lot to do with their sophisticated sound and perseverance.
You ain't ready. That's what the man at United Records told the five young black men who auditioned for him one afternoon in 1952. And rather than give up, they went back home and wrote a song using their turndown as a title. They weren't about to get depressed because they knew they had something, and it wouldn't be long before all of Chicago, and maybe the world, heard about the Flamingos. Like so many vocal groups of this era, the Flamingos came into being on a Chicago street corner when Jake and Zeke Carey decided that their job hunting was getting nowhere, so they might as well try to get rich quick. And when they walked into United Records after a few weeks' rehearsal, they were serious. Being told they weren't ready, somebody might have reasoned, meant that someday they would be. And the group rehearsed every chance they could get for over a year before they tried again. Besides the Careys, the Flamingos consisted of Johnny Carter, Paul Wilson, and lead singer Solly McElroy, and together they could really harmonize. A Chicago label named Chance signed them to a contract, and Golden Teardrops, released early in 1954, was a strong regional hit with blacks and whites alike. This sort of thing was hard to keep a secret in Chicago in the 50s, and pretty soon the group's manager, Ralph Leon, was approached by the Chess Brothers, who had most of Chicago's top blues talent on their label. Chess had a pop subsidiary, Checker, and that's where the Flamingos went next, although Leon died before their top 10 hit, I'll Be Home, was released early in 1956.
I'll be home my time. Please wait there for me. We'll stroll along together. Once more love will be free.
By now, the Flamingos had a new lead singer, Nate Nelson, and Louis Armstrong's manager, Joe Glazer, who got them on tours with Duke Ellington and other top band leaders, as well as a stint in Las Vegas at, where else, the Flamingo. But songs like A Kiss From Your Lips didn't do as well as the group hoped. There were complaints from black disc jockeys that they sounded too white, and it's true that their harmonies were a good deal more advanced than a lot of street corner singers. The way to go, then, was the way Solly McElroy had taken when he left. He joined the Platters, famous for their interpretations of pop standards, as well as for selling records by the bushel basketful. Glazer felt that Chess did a good job with blues, but was falling down in the pop department. So he signed the group with End Records in New York, the top of the line for vocal groups, and they recorded an entire album of standards. This was unusual enough for 1959, but they released the album without a hit single first and waited to hear which cut the public liked. That's the way it's done nowadays, but it was daring back then. and the public chose the right record, too. One of the ultimate expressions of the group harmony sound. Listen.
My love must be a kind of blind love. I can't see anyone but you. Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright.
Have Eyes for You sold and sold, cracking the pop charts and ensuring the Flamingos' fame. There were other records right down to the mid-70s with a bunch of different guys going in and out of the group, but the Flamingos never again made it quite as big. Mostly that was because the doo-wop sound was fading by the time they hit, but as I understand it, they're all doing pretty well these days, and I'm sure the Carey brothers would agree, it beat working.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
And I only have eyes for you.
This is Fresh Air. Sylvia Sims likes to tell you how she knows every brick on Manhattan's West 52nd Street. That's from the days when the street was lined with jazz clubs and never stopped swinging. As a teenager, Sims hung out at the clubs. As an adult, she's probably played nearly every cabaret in the country. I spoke with Sylvia Sims just before she performed at the kickoff concert for Philadelphia's Mellon Jazz Festival. Her voice has won her many longtime fans, including Frank Sinatra, who produced her album Sims by Sinatra. The album features standards, including That Old Devil Moon.
I look at you and suddenly something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. It's that old devil moon that you stole from the skies. It's that old devil moon in your eyes.
How did you meet Sinatra? How did you both meet?
We don't even know. It just happened. I think we met in the days of 52nd Street when I was a kid coming on the street to learn my craft, and he was a star at the Paramount Theater. And we both had something very much in common. And that wonderful thing we had in common was a fabulous woman named Billie Holiday and a street called 52nd Street, which was full of the most glorious sounds of jazz, and at that time was called swing. And that's how we met, I guess.
When you say you had Billie Holiday in common, do you mean as a common friend or as a common interest?
We had her in common as she became a common friend that we shared, but we had the love of her performance in common. I never knew. I knew I wanted to sing from the time I was born until the time I began to sing professionally, but I never knew how I wanted to sing until I heard her.
Well, you eventually got to be pretty close to Billie Holiday.
Yeah, because at first she thought I was some cuckoo character who was hanging out, you know, trying to be somebody's friend. And then she realized that I was just really a dopey kid who was terribly in love with her voice and terribly in love with her style.
Your singing has an incredible strength to it. I had a feeling that when I met you that your speaking voice would be similar to your singing voice because there's something so direct about your singing.
Not?
You know, as if you're telling somebody a story. Mm-hmm. You know, some singers have a totally different singing voice from the range that they speak in.
This is the way I sang when I was nine. This is the way I spoke when I was nine. It became less and less and less and less from the standpoint of octaves, but it was always there in that area. I always had a chest voice, and that's all, which is why when I worked in theater, I always played character ladies like Bloody Mary in South Pacific and things like that, you know.
I want to ask you about a specific song. I'm a great fan of Harold Arlen's songs.
Okay.
But he has a song called Hooray for Love, which has never meant anything to me, to tell you the truth. You have a recording of it, and it's the first time I really got the song, that I got both the melody and the lyric, and now it's a song I really like. Tell me what you think of when you sing that song, because it's made the song special to me.
It's a wonderful, exalted song. You see, the whole point is, it doesn't matter how young you are or how old you are, just that you are, and that you are alive and vital.
Here's to my best romance. Here's to my worst romance. Here's to my first romance. Ages ago. Here's to the men I've kissed, and to complete the list, here's to the one who said no. Love, love, hooray for love. Who was ever too blasé for love? Make this a night for love. If we have to fight, let's fight for love. Some sigh and cry for love.
You've been on the scene a long time. Tell me what the club scene was like when you first started out.
Well, the club scene, they were all everywhere. There was a little cellar. They opened a saloon, okay? And night after night, you could go from one saloon to another and hear Art Tatum and Coleman Hawkins and Billie Holiday and Billy Eckstein and Billy Daniels and all of these fabulous people. And I went from one club to, and it was summertime when I first came on the street. And there was no air conditioning in any of the clubs, so all the doors were wide open. But I listened to a lady on the air from a remote. She was working at the Three Deuces. And the doors were wide open, and I stood outside of that club for three shows. After she finished her second show, there was a place called the White Rose Bar on the corner of 52nd Street and 6th Avenue, and all the musicians would finish their sets, and they staggered their sets so people could go from one to another to another to another, both sides of the street, you know? And so she came out of the club, and she saw me standing there, and she said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm listening to you.
This is Billie Holiday?
Billie Holiday. And she said, go inside. I said, I can't. She said, how old are you? I said, 15. She said, no, you can't. So she said, come with me, and she took me with her, and when she came back, she took me the White Rose, and when she came back, she put me in the check room, where I became a very familiar figure.
Oh, because you were allowed to stay in the check room, even though you couldn't be in the club itself.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the musicians took you under their wing.
Oh, yeah. They didn't take me under their wing. They were just wonderful to me. First time I went uptown, lady said, do you want to go uptown? I said, where's uptown? I never heard of uptown. Well, uptown turned out to be Harlem. It turned out to be exactly like 52nd Street was. There were all these wonderful little after-hours places that people went to. And it was there that I met Fats Waller, Thomas Waller. He taught me about swinging.
I've just been listening to recordings that you made in the early 50s that have just been reissued on a box set called New York Cabaret Music.
Isn't that wonderful? On Atlantic. Yeah.
Did you record much then?
No, I had one album. No, I did about two albums on Atlantic Records.
And this music is excerpts from that album.
Yes. So from the two albums. They were little 10-inch albums. And one of the cuts on the album is very interesting because a young man named Larry Cart, who writes in Chicago, wrote me a letter and he said, I can prove to you that what you're singing on T for Two is a tenor saxophone chorus of Lester Young's. And that's true.
Oh, it's a great recording. It's a great recording of it.
Why don't you picture me upon your knee with tea for two? Two for tea, just me for you.
I will be yours alone. There'll be nobody near us to see us or hear us, no friends or relations on weekend vacations. We won't have it known that we've got a telephone. Dear, the dawn will break and dial away.
You're in your late 60s now and still singing beautifully. Have you had to change either your approach to breathing or to phrasing as you've gotten older and as your range has gotten smaller?
Oh, yeah, I had. Oh, sure. But my range got smaller and I got, I had to do a lot of things that are, if you'll forgive me, quote unquote, it sounds, again, egotistical, intelligent things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that some years ago, I lost a portion of my lung to malignancy, and I suffer from emphysema and asthma. But the feeling, no matter what happens to your range, and no matter what happens to your physicality, and no matter what happens to your age, the quality of caring and the intent does not change. And as long as that's there, the one thing that I require and the greatest necessity of my life is that I will know when the time comes for me to quietly step down and say, thank you very much. I want you to remember me as I have been and when I have given you the best part of my life. Because I have, from time to time, gone to see performers that made me wish I hadn't, okay? Not because I didn't love them just as much, and you see, I get goose flesh when I talk about it, because I don't want that to happen. I think that we should remember people as they were. We should remember how glorious it was to know them at their peak.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Singer Sylvia Sims.
I'll go my way by myself. Here's where the comedy ends. I'll have to apply myself with love and laughter and friends. Dark clouds in the sky above have put a blot on my fun.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What do you have?
Well, tonight we have a couple of stories on the Democratic nominee, or the man who will be the Democratic nominee, Michael Dukakis. Linda Wertheimer, our political reporter, tells us where his campaign has been and what hurdles are yet ahead. And also we have a report today on a speech that Michael Dukakis gave, a major foreign policy speech. And, of course, foreign affairs has been widely viewed as the governor's weak spot because he's had so little experience. Also a report on the reopening of a rocket fuel plant in Henderson, Nevada, which has been closed since another plant in that town exploded last month. The plant is crucial for the space and defense programs.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In honor of Flag Day, our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on our national anthem and the Pledge of Allegiance and why they're so confusing.
People have been complaining for years that the Star-Spangled Banner is impossible for the merely human among us to sing. What's interesting is that you never hear complaints about what should be an even more serious deficiency of the song, which is that nobody can understand what it says. By way of example, listen closely and be prepared to answer a listening comprehension question when I finish. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous night o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming? Now then, what is the object of the verb watch? That is, what exactly was it that Francis Scott Key was watching? The broad stripes and bright stars? The flag? Listen again. This time I'll try to simplify the wording and untangle some of the syntax. Oh, say, can you see by the light of dawn what we hailed so proudly at the gleam of twilight, whose stripes and stars were streaming gallantly through the night over the ramparts we watched? That's right. What Key and his companion were watching was not the flag, but the ramparts, the fortified embankments around Fort McHenry. Oh, they saw the flag, all right, but that's not what the song says. Now, you can write the song out and check it at your leisure. The point is that if you're like most people, you've never really thought about any of this before. But then, why should you have? After all, we learn these words when we're about 7 or 8, and children of that age could scarcely understand them. Over and above the stilted syntax, how many kids know what a rampart is? For that matter, how often does an adult civilian have occasion to talk about ramparts in the normal course of daily life? But why have we picked on an anthem that's so obviously incomprehensible, and how come nobody seems to mind? It's not just that the Star-Spangled Banner is an embarrassingly bad poem, if you actually stop to think about it. The fact is that we generally prefer for our patriotic ditties and oaths to be obscure. I was struck by this a year or so ago when I was helping my French-born wife prepare for her citizenship test. Her immigration lawyer told her to prepare for 2 items that were absolutely sure to appear on the exam. She should be ready to define a pocket veto and to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. It was the second of these she had trouble with. Oh, she learned the words all right, but she recited it funny. She said, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands." I explained to her that she'd got it all wrong. Real Americans say it as if it were 4 long words. "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands." Now, you couldn't do better than this if you deliberately set out to write an oath that children would find utterly incomprehensible. I suppose that most of us wondered idly about it when we were kids. What does this word pledge allegiance mean, and who's this guy Richard Stans? It's interesting that people should get so head up about whether the words under God should be in there or not, and yet be wholly indifferent to the fact that kids can't make heads or tails of the pledge in the first place. The fact is that our pledge and our national anthem are exactly as we want them to be. We don't really want people to ponder these words too deeply, no more than we want people to reflect too deeply about their love of country. As an Italian friend of mine once remarked, America is the only country whose citizens are patriotic without being nationalistic. And when you come to think about it, most of the really good anthems do seem to belong to countries with strong nationalistic traditions. God Save the Queen, La Marseillaise, Deutschland über alles, even Dixie, I suppose. Now, those are anthems with a sort of stirring words and rousing tunes that you can sing with nationalist fervor. For example, when you want to drown somebody else's anthem out. Well, but that sort of thing isn't really for us. What we want is a song we can mutter inattentively from the bleachers.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow we'll meet the screenwriter of A World Apart, Sean Slovo. The movie is autobiographical, about growing up white in South Africa with parents who are members of the banned African National Congress. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a recording of Pierre Boulez conducting the 1910 version of Stravinsky's Song of the Nightingale. And book critic John Leonard will review Gerald Clark's biography of writer Truman Capote. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Chris Spurgeon directed the show. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.